From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Since January 2007, 6,800 people have been killed. Since the year 2000, 24 journalists have been killed and 7 have vanished. These aren't Iraq stats. They're from a war much closer to home. The Mexican drug war raging in cities just across the U.S. border. In places like Juarez, Nuevo Laredo, and Tijuana, the mounting violence is all about the competition between drug cartels for control of supply routes north. And for journalists, it is one of the most dangerous stories in the world. Vicente Calderon is a veteran television reporter in Tijuana and editor of TijuanaPress.com. Amy Isaacson is a longtime reporter for KPBS, the NPR affiliate in San Diego. They spoke to us from Tijuana, where they're attempting to bridge the 15-mile divide between their two cities by joining forces on an ongoing radio and web series about the drug wars called Border Battle. This is from a recent report, a recording they made at 5 a.m. at the scene of newly discovered casualties in a residential neighborhood in Tijuana.
It looks like all of them are blindfolded, and they have their hands tied up with duct tape.
One has his pants down. It's Friday. This is the fifth discovery of bodies early in the morning this week. There's been bodies every day since Monday.
Calderon says he's been covering Tijuana for nearly 25 years, and though there has been drug-related violence for some time, he's never seen violence of this scale or severity.
It's just not the death toll, but also the gruesomeness of many of these killings, and also the fact that many innocents have been casualties of this war between two rival gangs.
It's almost like the different groups are trying to one-up each other with decapitations or with cutting people's tongues out. It just gets more and more hideous every day, it seems.
I want our listeners to hear some of your reporting. This was a visit to the Lower California Crime Lab in Tijuana.
Fernando Zuniga Chiquete, he's a forensic investigator with the state of Baja California. We went to visit him one day in late October, and at that point there'd been about 150 murders, I believe, in Tijuana.
Too much. Too much dead bodies. Some days are 9, other day are 6 or 4. I want to try to solve the situation, to bring justice to someone. My way of working here is to bring dead people to his relatives.
Mr. Chiquete was talking to us about how he was working some days 16 hours, that the lab had just actually run out of their year's worth of supplies in October. He was showing us freezers full of specimens. One of the ways that drug cartels have been killing or at least disposing of people is to dissolve them in big industrial trash cans full of acid. And so he had frozen jars of the liquid that had come out of these trash cans that they had to do testing on.
Tijuana is not a small town. The population is on the order of 2 million. How much has the drug trade penetrated the city itself?
We actually made this map, and we mapped out all of the killing for 2 months, from the end of September through the end of November. It is all over the city. There really aren't many areas that have gone untouched. Also, the violence has become more public. There's occasionally shootouts in the street, and so the risk of being touched by the violence, still rare, but it has become greater. And it's all over the newspapers. It's all over the media here. It's something that I think is in the back of most people's mind most of the time.
But that coverage, I gather, has changed somewhat because of the violence against journalists themselves. What was drug war coverage like, for example, 5 years ago? And what is the status quo today?
The problem of covering the stories associated with drug trafficking or with mafia has been dangerous here since the mid-80s, when the drug cartel organization that we know as the Tijuana Drug Cartel established themselves here. So the problem, the risk, has been here for a long time, specifically with investigative pieces in depth on the cartel. But in the last month, as part of this wave of violence here in Tijuana, we haven't seen and I hope we will not see that in the future, an increase of attacks on journalists. It's dangerous because you don't know who you will be dealing with, or you can go to a crime scene, you talk to somebody, and you don't know if you can trust them.
Have either of you felt particularly at risk? Have you been threatened?
I was several years ago. I was working with a local television station, and we were covering a series of murders, and we found out that they were linked to one of the drug organizations. And we began receiving phone calls, and it got a little bit scary when they began giving us the description of the cars that we were driving and some more detailed information of our routines. Fortunately, one of those guys that I think was associated with these threats was arrested, and I'm glad to say that I never heard again from something like that.
I think that I've generally, I don't know if this is correct or not, but felt some insulation in that I'm a U.S. reporter and come to Tijuana and then can cross back to San Diego. I feel that, you know, if they came after me, that it would cause an international incident. That's not to say, however, that U.S. reporters haven't been killed here in Mexico.
Is there any sense that the media owners have asked their editorial staffs to back off the story for either for safety reasons or one's more sinister?
I'll answer from the U.S. perspective first. There are two of us, two U.S. reporters from San Diego, Sandra Dibble, who works for the Union Tribune, and myself, who come to Tijuana regularly to report. San Diego TV stations generally don't allow people to come here to report.
I will say, Bob, that the only parallel that I see with Baghdad, it's the fact that most of the reporters from the U.S. media outlets, it's done by stringers or freelancers here. Amy and Sandra Dibble from the Union Tribune, the only ones who I see regularly working the beat here in Tijuana. And the thing is, this was happening even before this wave of violence. It's happening because more of budget reasons, I guess, and also there's more concerns about the insurance. That's very sad because I think the coverage in the U.S. media has a very direct effect on the lives of many people here in Tijuana. And I've seen very terrible journalism in U.S. media, and I will not tell them how to do their stories, but I will hope that they will be willing to spend more time working the beat.
I think that there's also a sense among many in the U.S., in San Diego in particular, that this is Mexico's drug war, but it is tied to San Diego as well. And at base, this is a fight for U.S. demand. And also, they say that 95% of the guns that cartels are using come from the U.S.
There are a number of perfectly rational reasons for the San Diego media and not to dig into the Tijuana drug war story. One, of course, is the danger to its staff. Another is the utter implosion of the media business that has put quite a crimp on resources even within the local community. But I wonder, since you just said what you just said, how much of it has to do with an indifference to a bunch of Mexicans who have made the mistake of getting involved with the druggies to begin with?
So many people have a tendency to just write it off as that's just Mexico and that's what happens. For example, last April, we did a story. There was a shootout that's actually the genesis of the violence that we're seeing now. There was a shootout and 13 people were left bleeding in the street. And a lot of people I talked to, my colleagues included, started to question, why are we telling this story? We don't tell stories about gang violence in San Diego, so why are we telling this story? And it's an education process of saying it's part of an international story that's playing out right on our doorstep.
Many of them think, well, it's Tijuana. What can you expect? Violence is a way of life in Mexico. And that's very sad because this eventually will affect the progress made in very specific sectors in San Diego. The economy of this region, it's closely linked. And I have to say, Bob, that this was unfortunately also happening in the Mexican side. In many ways, when I talk to public officials in Mexico, even the governor once told me, well, it's not nice people, the one who is getting killed. We need to say you cannot be used to this level of violence. And even the kids here are now familiar with the terms way people get killed as part of the drug trade. So the insensitivity is not just from San Diego to Tijuana, but also from many of the sectors of the government and the society. And this is the result of years and years of impunity and negligence and corruption in the Mexican side.
You met a woman named Melba Romero, a physician in Tijuana. What she had to tell you was, it gave me pause.
Dr. Melba Romero, she's a general practitioner in Tijuana, and we talked to her at a peace march a few weeks ago. And what she was saying basically was what a lot of people at this march were saying. The government here in Baja California, the government of Mexico, should just make a pact with a cartel.
We know that drug trafficking is going to be there. Nobody's going to end that. It's practically impossible. I think that they do need to pact. You do your things, but leave our people alone.
Do you care which cartel they pact with?
I really don't care. As long as they don't mix with us.
I think there's this feeling that the only way that the killings are going to diminish is if the government says, okay, guys, you pass your drugs, get them across the border, but just stop killing and stop kidnapping so many people. They don't see demand in the U.S. diminishing. They don't see governments, either the U.S. government necessarily or the Mexican government, being able to control something that generates, I think the estimate is something like $10 billion a year.
They tried to establish the rule of law here, but they think that the cartels are so powerful that there's nothing really that the authorities can do about it. There's some kind of nostalgia by the old drug traffickers, the ones who were just keeping the killing among themselves. It's very almost surreal, but people are so desperate for the level of violence and how is this affecting every activity around their lives. They just want a solution.
Amy, Vicente, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Vicente Calderon and Amy Isaacson are collaborating from their respective sides of the border on a series called Border Battle for TijuanaPress.com and KPBS, the San Diego NPR affiliate, KPBS.org.
Coming up, if no actual kids are depicted in kiddie porn, is it still wrong? The courts weigh in on porn tunes.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Earlier this month, a court in New South Wales, Australia, decided that Bart, Lisa, and Maggie Simpson are to be considered persons, at least when depicted having sex. And so it upheld an earlier decision that slapped a $3,000 fine on a man who had images of those underage characters doing unmentionable things. Last May, our Supreme Court upheld the 2003 PROTECT Act, an acronym for Prosecutorial Remedies and Other Tools to End the Exploitation of Children Today, ruling it illegal to knowingly promote, present, distribute, or solicit images of children, whether real, drawn, digitally created, or adults passing as minors, engaged in obscene acts. The material has to be judged obscene under the Miller test, which considers both community standards and artistic merit, but those are notoriously moving targets. Dwight Worley of Richmond, Virginia, is now 2 years into a 20-year sentence levied after his conviction on 74 counts of soliciting pornographic images of children, both real and imagined, in the form of Japanese anime. He recently appealed, seeking to have the counts related to the comic art dropped, but last week he lost his case. And that could affect the case of Christopher Handley, a 38-year-old Iowa man accused of purchasing manga, Japanese comics drawn using very few lines, depicting underage sexual acts. Charles Brownstein is executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, now working with Handley's defense. He says Handley's just a collector caught in the act of collecting.
Christopher Handley is a private collector of manga who ordered some untranslated Japanese comics or manga from Japan, which were intercepted by the post office in Chicago. There were 7 pieces in that mailing, and when he received them at his post office in Iowa, he was followed home where his entire collection was seized. They seized some 1,200 comics and graphic novels, hundreds of DVDs, 7 computers, but they're prosecuting for less than a dozen comic books. They pulled out everything but the kitchen sink, but they only found a few dregs in the faucet.
Fictional beings under 18 that are engaged in sexual acts not deemed obscene aren't illegal. Can you tell us what the characters in Handley's possession actually were doing?
I haven't looked at enough of the material to be able to give an expert opinion on it. What I can say is that the material in his collection is fantasy work. It's fantasy within the horror genre. It's fantasy within a genre called lolicon.
Lolicon is sexual material that is inspired by Nabokov's Lolita,
which is similar to barely legal stuff here in the United States. The hentai genre is a horror genre that depicts kind of supernatural beings engaged in sexual congress with human beings. And there's a taboo against pubic hair in Japan. And so consequently, if you're depicting a character nude, you're depicting them without the pubic hair. So naturally, this exaggerated cartoon figure that is already very simplified in its line detail, to the untrained, unknowledgeable eye, is going to look like a person below age.
Do you hear from comic artists who are trying to figure out where the legal line is that they shouldn't cross? I mean, in your experience, have cases like Handley's had a chilling effect?
A lot of artists are watching the Handley case very, very seriously. There's established works within the graphic novel medium that are of unquestionable literary merit, but that address juvenile and adolescent sexuality. Books like Ariel Schrag's Potential, which is a memoir that was drawn by an author when she was a teenager about her sexual coming of age, is potentially vulnerable if Handley is convicted, because that material depicts teenagers having sex.
But I assume that a work like that wouldn't be declared obscene under the law, which requires that the so-called Miller test be applied to it. And the Miller test has three parts. A, whether the average person applying community standards would find that work taken as a whole appeals to the prurient interest. B, whether the work depicts or describes in a patently offensive way sexual conduct specifically defined by the applicable state law. And C, whether the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. The jury must answer all three questions in the affirmative in order to convict. In the case of the work that you cite, it probably wouldn't meet the third test at least.
That work could still potentially be the target of a prosecution. And that's where the chill comes in. That's where the chill comes in for artists. That's where the chill comes in for retailers. That's where the chill comes in for academics. Do I want to take the risk of selling this work? Do I want to take the risk of owning this work?
No one defends child pornography. You have a legal case to make here, but is there any part of the slippery slope argument that the courts will often make that you buy when it comes to child pornography and illustration?
Nobody, including the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund or Mr. Handley's counsel, are defending child pornography. Child pornography is photographic evidence of a crime, and the people that participate in that crime through the possession of images, the manufacture or distribution of images depicting real people getting hurt, are what the PROTECT Act was created to prosecute. That is a crime that is unspeakable and that nobody should defend. When you get into the realm of art and you get into the realm of prosecuting people for ideas and for images that are rendered as lines on paper, then you're creating a category of thought crime, and that's not what our free society is about.
All right. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Charles Brownstein is executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. Now we turn to Mary Leary, former director of the National Center for the Prosecution of Child Abuse, currently associate professor of law at Catholic University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so the Supreme Court's decision last May made it a crime to offer or solicit explicit images of children, regardless of whether they are grown-ups dressed to look like kids or if they're depicted as line squiggles on the back of a matchbook, I guess. Am I right about that?
I wouldn't say they made it a crime. I would say what they did was uphold the constitutionality of that particular crime. And I would add as well that what they simply did was reject the argument that was made that this was a vague statute or that it was an overbroad statute.
Why does this provision in the law exist? I mean, who is harmed by Mr. Handley's possession of this material?
It's been accepted in some instances by the court, certainly by the United States Congress, that children outside the images are harmed by these pictures. And by that, I mean children who are exposed to these images, children who are sexually assaulted, because the research does support a correlation amongst hands-on sexual offenders and possessors of images of child sexual abuse.
The research there isn't conclusive, and obviously children will be hurt by pornographic images of any sort that fall into their hands, and also violent images, I would venture to say. So why these imaginative depictions when it poses such a challenge to artistic expression?
I would agree with you that there has not been the published study regarding a causal connection between the possession of child pornography or images of child sexual abuse and hands-on offending. However, let's be realistic here. We will never be able to get the social science study that says, hey, looking at images of children being victimized in sexual abuse causes you to abuse children, because ethically, we can never perform it. The demand that we have that study in order to conclude what most of the social science points to, I think, is an unrealistic one. But to get to your question, who is harmed by these images, again, we have to be clear what is in these images, okay? These are not gray area materials. It has to be material that's not only obscene, and you've already discussed the very high standard of the Miller test in terms of finding something obscene, but also it has to involve a minor engaged in bestiality, sadistic or masochistic abuse, lascivious exhibition of genitals, sexual intercourse in all forms, as well as some other qualities as well. So this is not gray area material.
Don't you see a distinction between images that are created with real people and the horrible consequences for the participants and so on, with the ruminations of some Japanese anime artist who's doing a horror comic book?
As a matter of public policy, I do see a difference, and the difference I see is defining the social harm. And when we define the social harm in the situation where we have a drawing where no human being is utilized, the social harm cannot be in the production. Where I think we disagree is there's still a social harm, I think, to that material if indeed it is obscene.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Mary Leary is the former director of the National Center for the Prosecution of Child Abuse and currently associate professor of law at Catholic University.
A couple of weeks ago on this show, Brooke misstated the name of a terminally ill man whose doctor-assisted suicide was aired on British television. His name was Craig Ewart, not Chris Ewart. We regret the error. Of course, it wasn't the first mistake we made this year at On the Media, and judging from the 2008 roundup of regrettheerror.com, we had plenty of company. Craig Silverman is editor of the website and author of Regret the Error, How Media Mistakes Pollute the Press and Imperil Free Speech. He joins us every year at this time to catalog journalism's most egregious blunders of the previous 12 months. Some accidental, some not so much. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You begin this year with the trend of the year, so why don't we?
I called it epic organizational failure. It's very common to see a single journalist go rogue. They plagiarize, they fabricate. But in this case, there were three examples of actual entire organizations that really completely fell off the wagon. You have a website in Japan, it was the website of a daily newspaper there, that had to basically be shut down and restarted because they were all the time publishing completely scandalous false articles, usually about the sexual proclivities of Japanese people. Then you have the Express newspapers chain in England, who had to publish a series of major front page apologies because they had done some really inaccurate and damaging reporting about a British family. And then the last one was stateside. You had a weekly paper in Texas called The Bulletin that was actually practicing plagiarism as pretty much a standard operating procedure. And that one was revealed by Jody Rosen at Slate.
Now, that's plagiarism on kind of institutional scale. There were still a couple of outbreaks of ad hoc plagiarism. Two, curiously, from the same author, Rick Riley, now of ESPN.com and ESPN Magazine, previously of Sports Illustrated. It happened to him not once but twice, not as perpetrator but as victim.
Apparently, you can understand now why he was hired by ESPN for such a huge amount of money, because his work is so good that people can't keep their hands off of it.
But the most bizarre aspect of this is not so much the plagiarism, but the confession, which is just simply delicious.
That's right. I'm calling this the accuracy quote of the year. One of the people who was guilty, his name is Dave Pratt. He's better known as a radio host in Vancouver, but he was writing a column for a Vancouver newspaper. And so when he was tracked down by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation to ask him why he had done this, he said, quote, "It was Saturday and I wanted to get out before noon."
Well, that's the explanation. Sorry for robbing the bank, Your Honor, but I wanted money.
You got to love the brutal honesty of it, I guess.
Okay, but maybe that's the confession of the year. It's not the correction of the year. That you award to humorist Dave Barry. What was the error and what was the correction?
This correction has a few names that are extremely hard to pronounce. I'm going to take a shot at it now, but the background is Dave Barry had written a column in the Miami Herald about the Olympics. He had an error in the column, and this is a correction that he published in the next day's column. "In yesterday's column about badminton, I misspelled the name of Guatemalan player Kevin Corden. I apologize. In my defense, I want to note that in the same column, I correctly spelled Prapawadi Jerome Ratanatarak, Pumpat Sapkul Chananart, and Porntip Baranap Ratsayatsuk. So by the time I got to Kevin Corden, my fingers were exhausted."
Okay, so that's kind of a goofy correction. Some were serious indeed. And you award your error of the year to the LA Times for reporting it did on an attack a decade ago of rapper Tupac Shakur. The reporting suggested that Sean Puffy Combs was involved.
The story was published in March. It was a story that took about 6 months of reporting to produce, and it was written by a Pulitzer Prize winner, Chuck Phillips. The story suggested, as you mentioned, that Sean Combs, some of his associates, were the ones behind this attack. It suggested that he knew about it, and the story relied on what were claimed to be FBI documents and that were provided to the reporter by a man named James Sabatino, who was an inmate. And the Smoking Gun just dug into this, and they said, look, Sabatino is a well-known con artist, and they looked at the documents, and they concluded very easily, it seemed, that they were all forged. And so the Times, on March 27th, just the day after the Smoking Gun report, apologized, and then on April 7th, not too long after, they actually issued a formal retraction.
What lessons do we learn from this incident?
You know, this is one thing journalists struggle with all the time, that we have to go into something and try to maintain our skepticism and try to be critical about the things that are being given to us, even if we really want them to be true or we know that there'll be a big story. And it's a very difficult thing for a journalist to do, to keep that distance. And in this case, I think it was one of the reasons why the Times story ended up getting published and why they didn't see that these documents were so troublesome.
So you look at corrections, you look at apologies, you look at errors, you look at ethical blunders, and you also look at typos, a couple of which caught your eye in 2008. Can you share them?
I think a lot of journalists would agree that the typo of the year is the kind of mistake that is really one of the most embarrassing possible. And I say that because back in the summer, a newspaper that is distributed in Vermont, New Hampshire, actually managed to spell its own name wrong on the front page.
Oops.
Yeah, so let's get their name out there. This is the Valley News, and they misspelled it by putting an extra S.
Now, sometimes publications get kind of ensnared by their own style book. Tell me about the case of the sprinter.
This was a pretty remarkable one. There's a website called One News Now. It's operated by the right-leaning American Family Association. And they have a standard practice in their style book that the word homosexual is inserted whenever there's the use of the word gay. And they've actually gone to the point where they have an automatic filter. So any story that comes in and they use some of the wire services automatically goes from gay to homosexual. Now, this really served them poorly when a gentleman by the name of Tyson Gay was running at the Olympic track and field trials for the United States. The result was a headline that read, "Homosexual eases into 100 final at Olympic trials." It just got better from there. The story reported that on Saturday, homosexual misjudged the finish in his opening heat. It also reported that asked how he felt, homosexual said, "A little fatigued."
Oh, man. I have nothing I can add to that. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is author of Regret the Error, How Media Mistakes Pollute the Press and Imperil Free Speech.
Coming up, Psychiatry's Bible is getting its periodic checkup.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Centre at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with a few of your letters. Sherman Aronson of Philadelphia agrees with the assertion last week of Michael Blastland, author of The Numbers Game, that the media may be exaggerating our economic woes. For instance, he writes, "I work for a small firm that grew from 65 to 130 since 2004, but 30 people were laid off in August when a big project was put on hold. Does that mean we've shrunk by 25% this year, or that we've grown by 60% over 4 years? On my observation last week that President Bush seemed oblivious to the reason why an Iraqi journalist hurled his shoes at him, Gene Zitfer of Washington, D.C. writes, quote, "Wouldn't it have been worth mentioning that in the pre-invasion era, no opposition journalist would have been allowed into the same room with the leader of Iraq? In fact, no opposition journalist would have been allowed to exist." And finally, regarding our singing commentary a couple of weeks back, "Oh, the humanity," moans one listener. Other reactions include such words as painful, harmful, chillingly unlistenable. On the bright side, some called it great, catchy, brilliant, and brave. And one listener declared it a perfect desecration of Cole Porter's enduring genius. Thanks. Keep the unequivocal praise coming to onthemedia.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
There's a saying that goes, "A good book is the best of friends, the same today and forever." But books that are periodically revised can be even better. Consider the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or DSM, the catalog of mind-based maladies designated by the American Psychiatric Association. Plagued by fears or fantasies, bad thoughts or bad behaviors, if the problem's in your head, it's in the DSM. Charting your psychic pain since 1952. The next edition, the fifth in 60 years, isn't due out until 2012. But now's the time when new disorders are debated, tested, and prepped for their debuts in the DSM-5. The world consults this book. This is a very big deal.
Because the disorder definitions that we provide are used by the FDA to determine whether or not a new medication might have an indication for treatment.
Dr. Daryl Regeer is the vice chair of the DSM-5 task force.
It's used by the NIH to assess the type of disorder that somebody is asking to research. It's also used by Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance companies to identify the condition that somebody is requesting payment of treatment for.
Most important, it's used by doctors to define what's normal and what's not. It was the DSM that officially declared homosexuality a mental disorder, and then in 1973, officially undeclared it. It's defined an ever-expanding range of phobias and addictions that we're still arguing about, but this time, demands for more transparency aim to crack open the window on DSM deliberations, so interested parties can weigh in before they are enshrined. Because once they are, the FDA approves drugs to treat them, and any further debate is drowned out in the flood of direct-to-consumer ads.
If you are one of the many who suffer from overwhelming anxiety and intense fear of social situations with unfamiliar people,
you know when you're not feeling like yourself. You're tired all the time. You may feel sad, hopeless, and lose interest in things you once loved. You may feel anxious.
You can feel it in so many ways. Cymbalta can help. Cymbalta is a prescription medication that treats many symptoms of depression.
One controversial diagnosis up for inclusion is gender identity disorder. For social conservatives and some religious groups, this is a definite thumbs up for inclusion in the DSM. If you think you're a woman trapped in a man's body or vice versa, you have a disorder. But Dr. Michael First, who worked on the last two editions of the DSM, says that for those in the transgender community, it's not so simple.
People who want sex reassignment surgery, people who are transgendered so much so that they feel like they have to go all the way and actually change their gender, they need to view this as a disorder in order to qualify for the surgery.
You mean to get insurance to cover it?
Insurance and also social acceptance. The people who are against it are people who see being transgendered as a lifestyle choice and part of the normal variation, and they just see the stigma.
Similarly, feminists stand on both sides of the debate over a form of PMS affecting 5% of menstruating women that is so severe it impairs their ability to function. It's called PMDD, or
premenstrual dysphoric disorder, a distinct medical condition. It causes intense mood and physical symptoms right before your period. Doctors can now treat PMDD with Seraphim, the first and only prescription medication for PMDD.
When the Seraphim commercials came out was when I got, you know, the aha.
Steph Prose was being treated for depression, even though she rejected that diagnosis and felt stigmatized by it. When she saw the Seraphim ad depicting her debilitating mood swings, her rages, and her guilt, she finally felt she had a real diagnosis and was deeply relieved and grateful.
Somebody knows actually what I'm talking about. And immediately I called my doctor and said, this is what I have. I want depression taken off the record.
Like so much in the DSM, diagnosis is a judgment call. But Steph Prose, who now blogs about PMDD at lifewpmdd.com, has no trouble passing judgment on whether it should be in the DSM.
My answer is yes. Trying to go to work every day and getting the energy to do it, it does. It affects you every single day. And to me, that is a disorder.
PMDD has languished in the appendix of the DSM, signifying that the jury is still out. It is a hot-button issue because, you know, this one's just for the ladies, and it could be used against them, all of them. But the political ramifications don't worry Steph Prose.
I hadn't really thought about it. I guess the way I look at it is kind of a sexist disease.
Serafam, just Prozac in pink, is still available, but the FDA demanded that Eli Lilly pull the ads because they described the symptoms of PMDD so broadly, they were virtually indistinguishable from what most women experience as PMS, a condition not currently up for inclusion in the DSM.
If we're in the business of treating PMS with psychiatric drugs, in part what we're saying is that there is a level of insanity to the suffering of PMS.
Jonathan Metzl, psychiatrist and author of Prozac on the Couch, Prescribing Gender in the Era of Wonder Drugs.
Historically speaking, psychiatric drugs have been used to convey the message that if you're not just suffering from an illness, but if you are not a good mother, if you are not a good wife, these are all conditions that can be treated with psychiatric medications. And I can say that historically, the blurriness of that line has gotten psychiatry into a lot of trouble. The mother's little helper phenomenon in the 70s is one example of that.
Valium.
Correct. We know that when the industry drives diagnosis, there's a process that happens that Peter Kramer, in Listening to Prozac, beautifully described as diagnostic bracket creep. People start to come into doctor's offices and say, I know this drug is indicated for a particular illness, but I've kind of got that. And the doctor says, that sounds good enough. We'll give you this medication. And what happens over time is that the diagnostic boundaries expand and expand and expand, so that a drug that was indicated for a very small subset of people over time becomes indicated and used for a much wider category.
50% of the population defines itself as shy.
Christopher Lane is the author of Shyness, How Normal Behavior Became a Sickness.
Enormous number of people have a profound dislike of speaking in public, but that doesn't mean they suffer from a psychiatric condition. And the effort on the part of these psychiatrists and the APA to broaden the net and include internet addiction and compulsive buying disorder and apathy disorder, relational disorder, all of these are basically codes for everyday experiences and fears and anxieties that should not be represented in a psychiatric Bible.
Lane says the media compound the problem by reporting only the upper range of the estimate of those who may suffer from a potential disorder, and by failing to report the size of the field studies, which often are quite small.
I mean, one of the studies, it was a telephone survey to 526 urban Canadians, came out with self-reported accounts of social anxiety that ranged from 1.9% to 18.7%. But only the higher figure was reported in the subsequent media literature. And what happens is then the public reads that or hears it on the radio and decides this is potentially a problem, certainly with social anxiety disorder, because the drug maker in question, GlaxoSmithKline, spent over $94 million on what it called a public awareness campaign for the disorder in question. It wanted people basically to rethink whether they were suffering from just shyness and to ask themselves whether it might be something more serious like social anxiety disorder.
The issue with all mental disorders is they're defined in terms of symptoms that we all experience every day as part of normal living.
Dr. Michael First, who worked on the third DSM and was an editor on the fourth.
Sadness, anxiety, palpitations, these are all normal phenomenon. It's only when they're sufficiently severe enough and cluster together that they begin to look like they're a potential mental disorder. So if you add a mental disorder to the DSM and it's defined in terms of everyday symptoms, you always run the risk of labeling someone who is normal with having a disorder.
The DSM task force is keenly aware of the risk of what are called false positives, a risk driven home in 1972 by psychologist David Rosenhan, who conducted a study in which 8 mentally healthy people gained admission to 12 psychiatric hospitals in 5 states by claiming to hear a voice saying empty or hollow or thud. That was their only deception. Otherwise, they behaved normally. All but one was diagnosed as schizophrenic. After admission, they said they felt fine and their behavior reflected it, but it took them from 7 to 52 days to be discharged with a diagnosis of schizophrenia in remission. When the study was published, 2 psychiatric hospitals agreed to undergo the same test. Could they identify the fakers? In fact, they identified dozens of them. Only none had actually been sent.
One of the big challenges of psychiatric diagnosis is the fact that it's still descriptive. It's based upon the way patients present.
Is this why we're all desperate for genetics to come up with, hey, you have a super short, you know, Q gene, therefore that's the cause of your condition?
We're desperate for that. That's never going to happen, I think. The reason why we haven't discovered the gene for schizophrenia is there is no gene for schizophrenia. It's a complex interaction of so many different factors. I would have imagined that after 15 years of research, given all of the advances, we'd have to have a lab test by now. And in fact, there was a series of research conferences before work on DSM-5 actually started. And one question that was put to every single research group is, are we ready to have lab tests or genes or neuroimaging as a diagnostic test? And every single time that question was raised, we always got the same answer, which is, while this is interesting, while there's data, it's not good enough to help us make a diagnosis. So we're going to have to wait till, you know, who knows when, but certainly not now.
So diagnosis is still an art.
Still an art. But it's also an art in the rest of medicine as well. I think anyone who's ever had back pain or an ill-defined medical illness will see how similar the rest of medicine can be to psychiatry.
Similar, but not the same. First concedes that the diagnoses of medical disorders rarely affect the culture as intensely as mental disorders do.
The DSM is an amalgam of social values and the science. I think the decisions made by the people in the DSM have direct impact on everyone.
That's why this veteran of DSM 3 and 4 stands with the many DSM critics who are calling for more public deliberations.
You want to see, how did this group of individuals who are making these decisions come up with their decisions? And more importantly, you want to have advanced warning so that if a proposal starts pushing its way through, people are aware of what that proposal is, and if they see a problem with it, they'll write in and say, you know, you haven't considered this. It's the interaction and the give and take with the entire both scientific community and the community at large which could produce the best DSM. That's the big problem with not having full transparency. It really robs the book of very, very important input at the earliest possible stages.
The DSM website offers some updates, but no details of the closed-door deliberations over proposed disorders. What's more, members of the task force sign a contract pledging not to divulge any confidential information, defined as, quote, all work product, unpublished manuscripts and drafts, and other pre-publication materials, group discussions, internal correspondence, information about the development process, and any other written or unwritten information in any form that emanates from or relates to my work with the APA task force or work group. Not exactly the model of transparency. Dr. Darrell Regeer, vice chair of the current DSM-5 task force.
This particular section was written by the intellectual property attorneys, and their concerns were that individuals who have inside access to the entire process don't use this for personal gain.
Nevertheless, Regeer does disagree with the critics. He believes it's best that raw data, rough drafts, and internal discussions stay behind closed doors.
Otherwise, it would just be cacophony and mass confusion.
I think that some of them wouldn't mind what you call cacophony in order to be able to have some input into the process before it is so well underway.
Well, it has been underway since 1999, and we put up in 2004 the DSM5.org website where people could provide their input. And in fact, we've had quite a bit of input coming in from the general public. The general public actually doesn't get that involved until it's clear what the disorders are and what the impact might be.
That's because they don't know what is under consideration.
Well, I think that you've seen a number of presentations in the press of people speculating about what might be under consideration.
Do you ever personally wonder that too much of the wide range of human behavior is being pathologized?
I worry about that a lot. And when I went into the field of psychiatric epidemiology, which is my research area, I was very concerned that in 1950s there was a book out called Midtown Manhattan Study that identified something like 84% of folks in Manhattan as having a mental disorder. So I've been concerned since that time of having something that is certainly much more credible. I think the DSM three criteria enabled us to narrow down on what is really a disorder and what is within the normal range of human, you know, emotional expression.
I think if you took the wide swath of depression disorders that are in the DSM and add them to the wide swath of anxiety disorders that are in the DSM and throw in quite a few of the attention disorders that are in the DSM, you could easily find that 84% of New Yorkers have a mental disorder.
I don't think you can.
Let's assume that the only goal of the DSM is to reduce the sum of human suffering. Under consideration for inclusion in the global compendium of psychic pain include apathy disorder, compulsive shopping disorder, relational disorder, internet addiction, and binge eating. Who among us cannot find ourselves somewhere in the DSM? Which prompts the question, not how much suffering is too much. We know mental illness destroys lives. But how much suffering is too little? Psychiatry has lowered our threshold for pain, and it's raised the bar for normal. Maybe the expectation that there is a normal is the most insidious disorder of all.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Preetschap and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Happy New Year, Bob.
Happy New Year, Brookie.
Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.